At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Shoes are today's economic indicator. Vice presidential candidates are the political indicator. And $20 as an indicator of whether or not a book's good enough to read. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 14th of August. Glad to have you with us. So retail sales numbers came out this morning. Maybe I should preface that with the all-important retail sales numbers, because you know how economists feel about consumers and what we mean to the American economy, right? That'd be we're everything. Anyway, retail was up 0.8% last month, a better bump than anybody had been guessing. And the stores behind those sales are counting on us in the extreme. Macy's, for one, its flagship store in New York City, is promising a giant new shoe department, more than 250,000 pairs of shoes on offer. So we sent Marketplace's Mark Garrison shopping to find out why shoes are worth such a retail fuss.
To get to the glittering new shoe showcase, you have to plow through a construction zone. Macy's is in the middle of a large-scale renovation. Up the escalator, the drilling fades, and you're in a shoe kingdom, the centerpiece of the redesign. It's filled with dozens of brands and throngs of shoppers, mostly women, though a few men linger, fiddling with their smartphones on benches. Canadian visitor Julie Doby is hunting for boots and is finding a lot more than she does in Toronto.
It's beautiful. Like, there's just so many shoes. It's so much better than any one thing we have.
She scopes out shoes first in most department stores, but even if she didn't, the shoe section is placed where she and other shoppers can't possibly miss it. Macy's is just the latest department store to radically revamp its shoe section. Barney's New York hands over a full floor to footwear. Harvard Business School professor Nancy Kane says shoes are increasingly getting top billing. Consumers feel justified spending big money on them, even in a tough economy.
Shoes last. You need them. You can say, I'm going to wear them many times a week.
And happy high-heel buyers are likely to strut through the rest of the store to buy more. Consultant Mary Lou Quinlan specializes in marketing to women.
These retailers know that a woman who walks into their shoe department is going to pick up a pair of heels or sandals, and the first thing they think of is, I think I better get a new something, a new bag, a new dress.
And even if all those feet marching through don't wind up in new shoes, Macy's could still make money when the foot traffic flows through the rest of the store. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
It's still low these many years after the financial crisis. Not so easy to get a mortgage in this country. Getting a car loan, though, not so hard at all. Lenders are opening their vaults for nearly anybody wanting to buy, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
The car market is looking pretty good to lenders these days.
It's a better bet to do auto lending than it is to do mortgage lending.
Paul Edelstein is an economist at IHS Global Insight. He says right now people are less likely to get behind on their car payments than they are on their mortgages.
I bet there are some households that figure that they can do without owning a home. They have another option to rent, but you need a car to get back and forth to work to make any payments on anything.
And as lenders feel less risk, they feel like making more loans. Edmunds.com estimates about 8% of current car loans are going to subprime borrowers. Alec Gutierrez is an industry analyst at Kelley Blue Book.
To be honest, they're pretty much lending to anyone with a pulse.
People are financing about 90% or so of the value of the car and taking out five-year loans, on average, to lower their monthly payments, which can lead pretty quickly to underwater car loans when you owe more than your car is worth.
Most consumers that buy their car, you will be underwater for a short period of time as you drive it off the lot.
During the recession, people stayed underwater with their car loans as the value of used cars fell. But today, Gutierrez says, that's happening less.
The used car market is about as strong as it's ever been.
Which means, come trade-in time, more people are finding themselves getting paid rather than paying for their old car. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
From the Marketplace desk of bad banking behavior, this today, one short week after being accused of illegally hiding billions of dollars of transactions it did for Iranian clients, Britain's Standard Chartered Bank settled today with New York's top financial regulator. It's the usual deal, a several hundred million dollar settlement. No admission of wrongdoing, probably, once the details are known, and the dodging of possibly stiffer penalties. From New York Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that.
Standard Chartered is accused of laundering money from Iran through its New York branch in violation of international sanctions. 60,000 transactions totaling at least $250 billion have been called into question. Lance Kimmel is a securities attorney.
I think this is a total and complete victory for the New York Department of Financial Services. This settlement is stunning in the speed in which it was arrived at, as well as the amount for which it was settled.
Under the terms of the settlement, Standard Chartered will pay a $340 million civil penalty to New York State. The bank will also have to let a New York State official monitor its international business. Last week, Standard Chartered denied the allegations. So why settle?
The threat of having its license revoked by New York State.
Kimmel says New York's big leverage was that it could pull Standard Chartered's banking license. It had scheduled a hearing for tomorrow. That's now canceled. Standard Chartered is still in settlement talks with federal regulators. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Hey, look at that. Another day when the markets did bupkis. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Nothing like a potentially momentum-changing development in a presidential election to make you want to talk to your friendly neighborhood public opinion expert, huh?
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said!
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. Paul Ryan, of course, is the GOP's momentum changer, or so they hope. Frank is here for our regular attitude check, what Americans really think about things. Frank, good to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
So this is the debate now, right, with the Ryan selection. What is the proper role of government in this society, big or small? What do you know about how people feel about that?
Boy, is that an interesting question. And as you say, probably one of the most significant issues in this whole election. We do know when we just asked basically, should government do more or is it doing too much that should be left to businesses and individuals? And that's the way we phrase it. Mm-hmm. We now have a new high in those same governments doing too much, 61%. And in general, government has a terrible image. 10% job approval for Congress this week. That's the lowest, tied for the lowest in history, a new number. So when you say government, people think bad negatively. However, when you get into a lot of specifics, all of a sudden people pull back and say, wait a minute, I don't want government to cut back on that or this. And that's the dilemma that all these politicians face.
Right. In your measurements, though, of how people feel about government and what it does, do people pay more attention to budget policy, which is what Congressman Ryan is known for, or things like the unemployment rate and gross domestic product and economic growth?
Well, you know, that's an interesting economic question, and I'm not sure any pollster has really specific data on exactly which economic indicator Americans pay attention to. But we do know that Americans are more concerned about straightforward things like jobs and the economy and employment than they are the more ambiguous but very long-term important issues like the deficit. So when you put those two together, although people say the deficit is very important, in the short term, they say if you got to prioritize, it's right now. Jobs, fix this economy in the short term, not the long term.
Yeah. For all the sound and fury, though, Frank, about this election for the past, 96 hours about Congressman Ryan, how much does the VP pick actually change things?
History shows not a lot. Of course, sometimes it's confusing because in 08, for example, McCain picked Palin just 3 days before they went into the convention. And usually candidates do get a convention bounce. So Romney's choice of Ryan here a couple of weeks before the convention is fairly unusual. And we may see a short-term bounce, minor bounce. But I think the big thing to watch for is the impact of the back-to-back conventions, which begin at the end of this month.
Right. Frank Newport, he's the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do them every week is called Attitude Check. There is more about it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure.
Lord knows New Orleans has been through enough in the 7 years since Hurricane Katrina hit. But the city has always had its spirit and music. The brass band specifically is a huge part of that. Woe be to those, however, whose instruments need repair, because believe it or not, New Orleans doesn't have a whole lot of people who fix broken horns. Keith O'Brien has that story.
On a recent afternoon at Edna Carr High School, across the Mississippi River from the French Quarter, students were getting tuned up on their baritones and trumpets. The horns today were working for the most part, but the instruments at Edna Carr and other public high schools in New Orleans are often old, dented, and used, says Edna Carr's band director, Christopher Herrero.
Last year we had instances where instruments just fell apart. Baritone horns would just break in half just because of use. And we had to piece them together with duct tape until we had a repairman to fix them, which is unfortunate.
Especially unfortunate because in New Orleans, repairmen, almost inexplicably, are hard to find. Or at least they were until recently. Stafford AG is best known as the trombonist for the Grammy Award-winning Rebirth Brass Band. But 6 months ago, he picked up a different instrument, a soldering torch, and some other tools as well.
Trumpet, bell, mandrels, trombone and baritone, bell, mandrels, my vice. It's a handy tool, my vice, yeah.
With his new company, Rebirth Instrument Repair, AG has launched the classic side project in some respects. By night, he's on stage. By day, he's in his garage with that soldering torch and vise. AG says there's a need for the work.
It's not that hard to mess up a trombone, to dent a trombone slide when you're in marching band. And you might just accidentally hit another trombone and now you got a dent in your slide.
But in other ways, it's extraordinary. To have your horn fixed by Stafford AG of the Rebirth Brass Band would be like having your guitar tuned by Eric Clapton, at least to a New Orleans kid. Of course, it's hard to picture Clapton working in his garage, sweating in the 100-degree heat, and fussing over an old trombone.
It's just rough. See, like now, it's stuck in second position. I mean, it has a dent in the slide in a couple of places.
In the last 6 months, AG has picked up contracts at several local high schools. He repairs up to 36 instruments a week, charging around $35 for regular maintenance on a horn. But he's flexible because he knows what a working instrument means to a young musician.
When the horn is working properly, it makes them want to play the horn. You know, it gives them a little bit more motivation. You know, if they horn, they got to play on a broke horn, they're not going to give you 100%.
Back at Edna Carr High School, Christopher Herrero agrees.
All right, horns up.
Up.
Concert ref and hold it. One, two, ready, play, and.
Last year, 16-year-old Philip Thomas was one of the unlucky kids in Herrero's band. He was forced to play on a mouthpiece affixed to his baritone with duct tape. No small challenge.
It was very, very hard because it'll keep slipping out. And, you know, when it'll slip out, you have to stop playing to put it back in. And you have to try to catch right back on to what everybody else is doing. It's very, very difficult.
But AG recently fixed Thomas's baritone. It's still chipped and weathered. The horn is easily older than the teenage musician playing it. But for the moment anyway, it's sounding pretty good. In New Orleans, I'm Keith O'Brien for Marketplace.
Coming up.
My son had two books to read over the summer, Great Expectations and The Odyssey. So I figured $20 a book was reasonable.
Kind of cheap if you ask me. Freakonomics in real life straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so not so much, really. The Dow Industrials ticked up 2 points, essentially flat, 13,172. The NASDAQ off 0.2%, 5 points, 3,016. The number of the S&P 500 also flat, 1,403. That July rebound in consumer spending that had Mark Garrison shoe shopping today bumped up retailers. Home Depot added on 3.5%. Discounter TJ Maxx put on almost 2%. And cosmetics maker Estee Lauder applied 9%. Saks earned more than expected and rose 6% today. Financials, kind of mixed. Bank of America added 0.75%. JP Morgan Chase rose 0.3%. Morgan Stanley, though, cut back 1%. And Goldman Sachs off about 0.3%. Groupon gave up more than 1/4 of its value today as weak results fed questions about the viability of its daily deal business. Angie's List, meanwhile, struck off nearly 16% on worries that insiders can now sell their shares. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.73%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace State Book, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its monthly Consumer Price Index. The Federal Reserve issues industrial production data for July. And foodies celebrate Julia Child's birthday. The star of The French Chef was born 100 years ago. Bon appetit. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If there's one moment of original sin in this year's presidential race, one key point of fundamental economic disagreement, it's to be found in the pages of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the stimulus program passed a month after the Obama administration took office. Michael Grunwald covered the stimulus for Time magazine, where he's a senior correspondent. He's turned that work into a book about how all $831 billion worth of that package came to be and what effect it had on the American economy. The book is called The New New Deal. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Can we say, as an objective fact, that the stimulus plan actually did stimulate?
Yeah, I think we can. Certainly, all the objective economists who have looked at it, there's overwhelming consensus that it certainly did create jobs, and it certainly did promote growth after a terrifying freefall. You look, the job losses peaked the month before it passed. And right after it passed, it was the largest quarterly improvement in economic growth and jobs that they'd had in 30 years. There's no smoking gun because you can't run a double-blind study of an alternative U.S. economy to see how it would perform without stimulus. But certainly the ballistics match.
Wait, and other unfortunate metaphors, I guess. I don't know. It was sort of advertised as a jobs bill, but it was really so much more. I mean, there was a lot of stuff crammed into this thing.
You know, it was called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and short-term recovery was a very important part of it. There was state aid for that and tax cuts and a lot of aid to victims of the Great Recession. But there was also this long-term reinvestment part that people don't understand. There was $90 billion for clean energy at a time that we were spending a few billion dollars a year. You know, the factories to make all that green stuff in the United States. You also had Race to the Top, which people know as this game-changing education reform, but they don't know that it was part of the stimulus.
You are, it is clear in this book, you are a fan of the stimulus bill. You think it was necessary and it did its job. I wonder, though, if there's any sympathy on your part for the countervailing argument that piling on debt in an American economy already in recession is not, the Republicans would say, a good thing to do.
Well, you know, the stimulus isn't perfect. It was put together by imperfect human beings through an extremely imperfect legislative process. There's some stuff in it that doesn't stimulate, and this did pile $800 billion in onto the debt, and at the time it added to the deficit. But of course, deficit spending is what you need at a time when the private economy has essentially shut down. When the economy goes to hell, people don't have profits, corporations don't have profits, so they're not paying taxes, and people don't have jobs, so they're not paying taxes, and that's how you get a deficit.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You have an interview, or you sat down and talked with Evan Bayh, former senator from Indiana, and he said at some point, this is the last stimulus package we're ever going to see in this country.
That's right. He said that could be the last sentence of my book, and it almost was. But you know, we'll see. Even Mitt Romney is on the trail. Sometimes people will ask him what he wants to cut, and he'll say, "Well, you don't want to cut spending too fast because that'll hurt the economy."
How much blame does the president get for, if I could sort of paraphrase you here, screwing up the sales job on this thing?
There's a funny scene in the book about when they were putting together the making work pay tax cuts. And it turns out that that less than 10% of Americans know that they got it. Hmm. And that's because they sort of dribbled out the tax cuts by diminishing your withholding. So you maybe got $8 or $9 in your paycheck a week, and nobody had any idea about it. Now, Rahm Emanuel was telling me that he was kind of raising hell about this while it was being put together. He said, "We're denying ourselves an Ed McMahon moment, you know, that kind of squeal of public publishers' clearinghouse pleasure when you get your envelope in the mail." It turns out that most of the actual things in the stimulus, the tax cuts and the infrastructure projects and the clean energy, people actually like them. They just don't like the stimulus. And there's a reason that even President Obama won't say the word anymore. And it really has become toxic.
Michael Grunwald, he's a senior correspondent at Time Magazine. His most recent book is called The New Deal, about the Obama stimulus program. Michael, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me, Guy.
If you want to track for yourself where all that stimulus money went, there's a government website for that. We've got a link to it on our website. It's marketplace.org. There is, as we all know, just one president of the United States. But right now, it's all about the Romney-Ryan team on the GOP side. And seeing as how Governor Romney campaigns largely on his business record, do co-CEOs at companies actually work? Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji has that story.
4 years ago now, President Obama introduced Joe Biden as his running mate like this.
"So let me introduce to you the next president."
He corrected himself a moment later. And just a couple of days ago, Governor Romney made a similar gaffe.
"Join me in welcoming the next president of the United States, Paul Ryan."
Mistakes aside, we are all aware that constitutionally, there can only be one president. Co-CEOs of a business share power legally, either by terms laid out after a merger, or they co-own the company.
In other types of organizations like politics, it's much more functional or informal, but it can be equally effective.
Stephen Ferris is a finance professor. He did a study about co-CEOs. Ferris tracked 120 businesses over a 20-year period. Those run by two heads had stronger returns. The key to success is what he calls complementarity, educational backgrounds and expertise that are different.
Some of the co-CEOs would maybe have primary responsibility, say, for manufacturing and the engineering and product design, whereas the other CEO might have more responsibility for marketing and distribution.
But Ferris is a finance professor.
"Hello."
I called presidential historian Richard Norton Smith to see if there's any proof that power sharing works on a presidential level. He points to the 36th vice president of the United States, Richard Nixon. He was Eisenhower's veep.
"It was a genuine balance of talents, experiences, weaknesses."
Since Nixon, Smith says we've had a few of what he calls deputy presidents, Walter Mondale, Dick Cheney, and Al Gore. But he says choosing a vice presidential running mate is less about co-running a country and more about co-running a campaign, where the return on investment is getting elected. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
I had a conversation a month or so ago with Stephen Levitt about the freakonomics of getting kids to get good grades and how Levitt says we ought to just pay him. $50 for an A was what he got when he was a kid. Me? Not one thin dime, but that's a whole nother story. Anyway, Jerry Ellen Dow heard that segment and tweeted us a picture of two crisp $20 bills, one labeled Great Expectations, the other labeled The Odyssey, and a note saying the money was there for the taking by her 14-year-old son if he read the books in question this summer. So, of course, we had to call her up to see what happened. Jerry, it's good to talk to you.
Thanks. It's nice talking to you, Kai.
So you heard me talking to Stephen Levitt about the Freakonomics of paying kids to study. And what did you do? Tell me about your experiment.
I'm always looking for ways to motivate the kids because they don't seem to be really excited about school themselves.
Shocking.
I thought, yeah, it is. So I thought that, my son had two books to read over the summer, Great Expectations and The Odyssey.
So, all right. So how much were you going to pay him?
So I figured $20 a book was reasonable.
Oh, man, 20. See, I'm not going to read The Odyssey for $20.
Yeah, you know, as it turns out, he felt probably that way as well.
So tell me what happened.
So what happened was I think he finished Great Expectations maybe 4 days ago, 5 days ago, and then he started The Odyssey 2 days ago. And I just have to point out that school starts tomorrow.
Yeah, so you're going to get your $20 back.
Well,
no, are you going to give it to him? Come on.
He's 250 pages into it. Now, the hesitation was that he seems to be plowing through it, which I don't understand how you can do that.
Yeah, no. You're going to prorate this then? Is that what I'm hearing you tell me?
We had a really heated discussion yesterday about whether I intended to pay him if he got it done before school or before the comprehensive test.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point, right? Which I should probably raise with Stephen Levitt. You got to define the terms of the agreement.
Yes, and I was not clear on that. Although I think as it happened, you know, I had some different ideas about what I would have done if I was doing it over again.
Oh, like what?
Well, I would have offered him more than $20
yeah,
for
you got
a 500-page book that was written 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. Now, Levitt and Dubner, the guys behind Freakonomics, would say, well, your sample size is a little small and you need more information over time.
So you think I should maybe have more kids and do it longer? Is that what you're suggesting?
No. Well, that's a personal choice, actually. But really, you need to do the experiment over a longer period of time so you can have more data, more information, right?
And with more rigorous controls
yeah.
in terms of what the expectations are. Yes.
And are you thinking you might do this again next summer? I guess you're going to wait and see how it goes, right?
Yes, I'm going to wait. I don't know.
This is so funny. You are clearly conflicted about this.
I am conflicted about it, yes.
Huh. Well, Jerry, thanks a lot for your time.
All right. Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which comes to us courtesy of the Census Bureau. Shortly after 2:29 this afternoon, Eastern Daylight Time, the press release says, the U.S. population clock hit 314,159,265. I'll take a minute, let you visualize that number. Write it down if you have to. 314159265. Kind of cool, huh? Kind of cool. All right, we're done. We got to go. Today, the Dow ticked up 2 points. We'll call that basically flat. The NASDAQ off 0.2%. That is 5 points. The S&P 500 ended right where it started. Thanks to Mary Dew and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Haas and Rod Abeed. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.